This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. Kia ora, you're listening to Reserved Recommendations, and this is another solo mini-sode. I just really wanted to get an episode out before the end of the month, and for a variety of reasons, including attempting to buy and sell a house, famously a very relaxing, very easy process, I find myself short a proper episode, and so you get one of these. I'm not sure if it's going to be full length. We will see how long this discussion takes, but with any luck, it will at the very least give you something to do while you do the dishes or walk the dog, and it might even be, you know, illuminating, entertaining, one of those things. So the idea I wanted to talk about is something that I'm calling the poisoned wound. As always, when I come up with one of these ideas, it's perhaps a bit of a grandiose term, but I'm going to explain what I mean with it. And with any luck, it will mean something to you, and it might help you understand some stuff maybe in the world. The idea came to me from a series of conversations I've had and things that I've watched lately. So the first thing was that, as happens from time to time, someone got in touch with me about a role-playing game that I co-wrote many years ago, which is called Normality. If you're very interested in that, you can find it on my itch page, which is objectivereality.itch.io. The very short version of that is that it is a deranged screed disguised as a role-playing game, constructed very much as an attempt to hurt specific people that myself and my co-author had problems with. The odd afterlife of it is that, because of its particular position regarding the general zeitgeist on the internet with free role-playing games, people find it in particular places, and it has big effects, outsized, I would say, effects on them every so often. The person that I was talking to pointed to a particular thing in that game where I straightforwardly lift James K. I do credit him, but I straightforwardly lifted James K. Baxter's poem, The Māori Jesus, which is an account of the martyrdom of Jesus Christ viewed as the persecution by state forces, really, eventually culminating in the committal to a mental institution and lobotomization of Jesus as a result of him being born as a Māori man in, now I would have to go back and check when the poem was written, but following the vague trajectory of James K. Baxter's career that I have in my head, I would put it in the 1960s. Might be early 70s, not especially relevant. And in the course of that conversation, I explained that what I was trying to do by grabbing that thing, or why that thing resonated with me, was that I'd hit on this idea that in the game, one of the things that we were channeling was the idea that there's this sort of creative force or generative force or magic or soul or something that is part of a healthy reality, which in our reality, in the reality that we're describing through this text, has become poisoned and is septic, is harming instead of helping. And so that idea of things turning septic or poisoned or, you know, healing wrong was just kind of in the back of my head. And then I watched the movie Cargo. Incidentally, if you haven't watched Cargo, brackets 2017, you should do that. If you are at all interested in not especially scary horror movies, then this is a much, you know, it's a superior example of the form in my view. It is, without giving away too much stuff, it's a zombie movie which does some more than usually interesting things with the kind of visual aesthetics of the zombies and their life cycle, I guess. It comes from a short film which was originally released on YouTube. I don't think you can find that original short film anymore. I had a look and it doesn't seem to be out there anymore. The short film is really about someone using the trick, knowing that they're going to turn into a zombie and using the trick of like using decaying meat on a stick, like the carrot on a fishing pole out ahead of a donkey in a cartoon, you know, to steer themselves in a particular direction and prevent themselves from harming the kid that they're carrying. And the movie Cargo does have that element, but it only happens right at the very end. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there. And the core thing that Cargo is sort of secretly about is that it deals with the idea of transposing a zombie outbreak to Australia. And that has two effects. One is that there is actually like a government response. It's an inadequate government response, but there is a government response of a sort to the zombie outbreak, because Australia is a government that has like a functional nationalized health system. And in the case of Cargo, what that is it results in them dropping all of these kits all across Australia out of planes, presumably. And you can pick up these emergency medical kits, which give you instructions on what to do if you're bitten by one of the infected people. And it also gives you, like, you've got 48 hours after infection before you basically fully turn. So it gives you a little, like, one-use wristband watch timer that you can wear that, you know, the idea is you put it on immediately that you get bitten and you know exactly how long you have left. It also gives you a little spring-powered captive bolt gun thing that you can use to kill yourself by shooting a spike through your own head when it's clear that you're about to run out of time. And it's like a list of all the symptoms that you can expect. All this kind of stuff that you don't really see in American horror movies, because the idea of there being even a bad public health response to a zombie outbreak doesn't really factor into their thinking, I think. So that's an interesting detail to start with. The other thing that it does is, by putting it in Australia, it contrasts the government approach with the Aboriginal approach. And consistently the government approach comes out worse. And it comes out worse by dint of being very individualistic and very focused on, like, people taking care of themselves and their families and taking responsibility for tracking their own infection and using the little suicide thing to kill themselves if it's, you know, too late in the process for them to be able to function. And in the course of this, I suppose I should give you the other side, whereas what is revealed as the movie goes on is that the disease outbreak has been a catalyst for Aboriginal people to leave settlements where they're under government control and go back to their ancestral lands and resume ancestral ways of living and engage in a sort of armed community defense against the zombies, which is shown to be because of its collectiveness, I suppose, shown to be much more effective than the atomized European government's way of doing things. That's not really what I want to talk about, though, because there is a single character that you encounter in the course of so the main character in the movie is played by Martin Freeman. His character is called Andy, but I have a terrible name, a terrible head for characters' names. I am likely just going to keep calling him Martin Freeman. Once I recognize an actor, I get stuck on his name as an actor, or their name as an actor, rather. In the course of the movie, you watch Martin Freeman, Andy's odyssey across Australia with his infant daughter. And he encounters all of these characters, and you kind of get to see their various responses to what's going on, which are all illustrative in various ways. But I want to talk to you about a guy called Vic. So Andy encounters Vic trapped under a big heap of gas cans, you know, gas tanks. Thinking about, you know, if you have replaceable tanks for gas at your house for cooking or water heating or whatever, those great big gas tanks, he's trapped under a pile of those, and Andy uses his ute, his pickup truck, to tow the gas tanks off him while Vic keeps the zombies off them both by shooting them with a rifle that he has. Vic takes Andy back to his fortified compound, and you meet someone who you initially assume is Vic's wife, although she seems very uncomfortable. And what is revealed about Vic is that he is essentially holding her captive. Her husband was part of the staff at the gas plant where Vic also worked. And when people started to turn, Vic locked everybody in, stockpiled a bunch of gas at this facility that he had access to, and essentially used the leverage of there not being any safe place outside of the compound to keep this woman, Lorraine, stuck there with him. And the work that he is engaged in, if you like, that he attempts to get Andy involved in, is that he has been catching Aboriginal people and keeping them in cages as bait for the zombies. And he then shoots the zombies and harvests anything of value that they might have on them from when they were humans. And here's the thing. I think Vic is a fascinating villain because he becomes kind of the recurring villain of the movie as it goes on, insofar as it has a villain. Because the thing about Vic is he's got a way about him that that really sells you on the idea that he hasn't had an easy time in life. Nothing that he has wanted has ever come easy for him. He's got a leg in a leg brace, which further communicates that maybe like his disability has put him in a position where he's been subject to some sort of abuse or been disadvantaged, or like people haven't taken him seriously. Maybe that contributes to the fact that he's been unsuccessful with women up to this point. And he sees the zombie outbreak as the chance to turn everything around for himself. But that comes at everybody else's expense. And it's a fascinating portrait of a villain, because people talk about the idea of, you know, the villain where you can – where they maybe have a good point, that, you know, that's a classic of discussion of Marvel movies. And Vic doesn't have a point. Vic fundamentally misunderstands the nature of the situation that he's in, because his entire understanding is based on the prediction that the world will eventually get back to quote unquote normal. And by engaging in all of the stuff that he's doing, by, you know, doing this zombie killing and harvesting program, by hoarding gas in this compound, by keeping Lorraine with him in the hopes that he can like wear her down over time with gifts and all of this stuff, that when things go back to normal, he will have positioned himself such that he is going to be on top. He's not really interested in community support or community aid. He's interested in reinforcing exactly the same power relations that he's been abused by, only now in his favor. And I think that is just such an apt portrait of a particular type of guy. And I think because that's incel mindset, right? That is, I've been abused by the world. It is natural that some people abuse others. I really want to be the abuser. And I was thinking about that for days afterwards, because, of course, if you follow this show, you will remember that my previous episode was with Ross Palethorpe talking about the movie Enemy. And the two protagonists of Enemy, both played by Jake Gyllenhaal, are more of these guys who see themselves as put upon and as disadvantaged by the circumstances of their lives. They're two guys who are both frustrated in their careers. One of them's a not very successful academic, and the other one's a not very successful actor. They both find themselves acting out in their relationships with women because they feel that those relationships are stifling and are limiting their potential, but they can't articulate that, and so they spin through this process of mutual antagonism and eventually, arguably in some ways, mutual destruction. But also, going back to the story of Enemy, there is a point towards the end of the movie where one of the doppelgangers, the one who is an academic who most directly has cause to kind of envy the life of the other doppelganger, who is an actor who, even though he's not really very successful, is still somewhat more kind of glamorous than like teaching the same class to a bored group of 20-somethings over and over again. He gets the opportunity to completely assume that man's life. And the first thing that he does when he steps into this man's world, is recognized by his wife as not being the same as her partner, but accepted anyway because he seems like he's a better option. The very first thing that he does is go into that guy's pocket and find a key to an underground sex club. You know, he immediately sets in place a plan that will undermine everything that is potentially good. Because he just, there's a wound there, right? To return to my turn of phrase from the start of this episode, there is a genuine wound in Vic. Vic has had a hard life. Bad things have happened to him. There is a genuine wound in both of the Jake Gyllenhaals in the movie Enemy. But that wound is poisonous. They're not taking the steps to drain it, to have it heal correctly. Instead, what they're doing is they're attempting to replicate the thing that hurt them, but this time to put themselves in a position of power so that they can be the dominant one and the one that does the hurting. And the reason that that all kind of was banging around in my head, I suppose, is that for a number of reasons, which I won't go into to spare the guilty, I am in the position at the moment of spectating a lot of right-wing conspiratorial nonsense posting on Facebook and sometimes receiving some of that conversation in real life. Like, I really don't want to go into the specifics of the detail because those are not my relationships to mess around with. Suffice it to say, I can't do anything direct about it. These are not people that I can safely get into fights with. And even if I wanted to, I don't know that necessarily getting into fights with them would be the best course of action. However, the thing that is really interesting about all of these people who I am observing in this kind of behavior is that there is this sense of aggrievement in the way that they are posting about what they're saying. So it's not just vaccines are poison. It's the truth is now coming out that vaccines are poison. Everybody who has ever doubted me about that is going to suffer, and they're going to come and beg me for forgiveness because I understood and they didn't. Or it's not just that climate change is a lie. It's that powerful people who have promulgated the lie of climate change are about to be punished, and everyone who has ever doubted me will be forced to apologize. Again, it's this position of having been wounded and not understanding the nature of the wound and not being able to take the step that would actually heal that, instead just seeking to be on the top in the power dynamic. I've even had in-person conversations with people who I know have deeply weird views. In this case, it was about trans people. And they couldn't not say it. It was completely orthogonal to the conversation that we were having, which was, again, a situation that I needed to be in, and picking a fight with that person in that moment was not an option. I want to be really clear that I'm not, you know, putting myself in spaces to hang around with people who believe vile things just for fun. I'm not tolerating that in order to make my own life easier at other people's expense. Sometimes, unfortunately, one must coexist with people who think terrible things for a particular period of time, and choosing to make the terrible things that they believe the focus of that discussion will help nobody. And yet, in the course of a cup of tea and an unrelated chat about the weather, the vile things come out. And in this case, it was almost daring people to take offense so that offense could be taken in response. You know, they were digging for an opportunity to say so much for the tolerant left. And I find it fascinating and sad. And I guess this is why I felt the need to record this and share it with the world. It's the first time that I have found people who think these horrible things relatable in some sense. Not in the sense that I think that their beliefs have any merit. Not in the sense that I think, you know, they are responding, you know, like this is really about economic anxiety or anything like that. It's purely in the sense that if you handed me a button and you said that if I pushed that button, then anyone who had ever been mad at me for any reason would have to come and apologize for having been mad at me, I am not sure that I would not push that button. And I am especially not sure that I would not push that button if you told me that it was, I don't know, going to cost me a sum of money, or it was going to make a person on the opposite side of the world fall off a bicycle and die. I think if the magic power was in my grasp to retrospectively be proven right about everything that I have a bee in my bonnet about and have everybody who has ever picked a fight with me about it have to come and apologize to me about that, that's a hell of a drug. Anyway, like I say, this is a shorter episode. If you would like to go back and listen to full-length episodes, you can find them through the NPR website. We are also, for our sins, on Spotify and all of the other major streaming platforms. I would like to finish off by plugging my wife's podcast, Sick and Tired Aotearoa. If you would like to hear someone talk in really great detail and candor about chronic illness and what that's like, I think you should go and check that out. I would like to plug an Instagram account called Māori by the River. That's the guy who came and talked to me about Normality, the role-playing game, and started some of these thoughts spinning. He's a poet, and he primarily uses his Instagram to just share static images of text of his poetry, and it's really good. In terms of my things, go check out wolfboy.bandcamp.com. New music goes up there periodically, and I have a thing I'm working on that I want to get out real soon, although, as previously noted, attempting to sell a house. So we'll see how that goes, right? And finally, I guess keep an eye on my itch page. At the same time as attempting to create music, I'm also attempting to write a thing, and I am telling you guys that that thing exists largely as a way of keeping myself accountable for working on it. I have had one round of feedback on it, which is kind of positive and is giving me a little bit more juice and energy for it. But again, as noted, attempting to buy and sell houses, which is very fun and relaxing, and everyone should do it. Anyway, that has been the episode for now. As I say, this is a short one. I hope to have a longer one sometime reasonably soon. Bye for now. You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatū People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes of this show at npr.nz/show/reserved on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube.
You can find me at Objective Reality on Blue Sky or send emails to objectivereality@gmail.com. You can also follow Reserved Recommendations on Facebook or Instagram.
And finally, Manawatū People's Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.